So I'd like to begin by thanking the organizers for inviting me here to this conference. So we've seen lots of examples of self-organization in physical and chemical systems in this conference, and just a few from the point of view of biological and ecological systems. So here's an example of self-organization in a biological system. I mean, I should point out that in the physical and chemical systems that a lot of people have spoken about over the last few days, it's clear that there's self-organization going on. In biology, in many, many circumstances, it's hugely controversial. Here's an example where it isn't hugely controversial. This is a Petri dish that's a few centimeters in diameter, and this is work by Berg and Boudrine, and basically what happens here is that you inoculate this dish, which has got agar in it. You put a little bit of bacteria on there, and then you just leave it for a few days, and then you stain it so the different colors correspond to different density of the bacteria. And what you can see here is you get this nice pattern. And there are quite a few models that have been developed for this sort of pattern formation. And basically what's happening here is that the cells are secreting chemoattractants, which are signaling chemicals, and then they signal to each other and they self-organize as a result of moving in response to this signal, creating the signal, destroying the signal. Here's an example from the work of Eshel Ben Jacob. Here are same sort of experiment. The only difference between these plates is that you've got different concentrations of agar here, so different hardness of agar. So an intriguing question to ask is that if self-organization occurs in chemistry and in physics and in these lower sort of biological organisms, does it occur in higher biological organisms? For example, can you explain this pattern formation in terms of self-organization? And the first person to attempt to do that was Alan Turing, and I'm sure you all know the two species Turing reaction diffusion model, where U and V are chemicals, and then this is diffusion, and this is the reaction terms. And of course the beauty of the diffusion driven instability is that you have a system that's stable in the absence of diffusion, and then you add on to it the stabilizing process of diffusion, and you get an instability. And that is a very important message actually for biologists, the idea that a lot of biological thinking is linear, and linear thinking would tell you if you had a system that was stable and you added a stabilized influence to it, you would get something that was more stable. And this is an intrinsically nonlinear interaction that's occurring here. And it's also a very important lesson to biologists in terms of the reductionist approach. And here you have something that's greater than the sum of its parts. Again, if you went into this system and looked for the destabilizing chemical, you wouldn't find it. All you would find would be stabilizing processes. It's the interaction that gives rise to the destabilizing process. Nope, these are just like there are many, many different models, like the Gray-Scott model that Michael Ward talked about yesterday, but these can be all sorts of different things. Yeah, so there's no special there's no special form. Well, with apart from the fact that they've got to be of a certain form so that you get instability to occur. Now, what Turing said was he said that once you get this instability leading to the spatial pattern, which is just a spatially varying profile of U and V, his idea was that one of these things would be something called a morphogen, which is the name for giving rise to structure. And the idea would be that where this chemical was high, you would get pattern to form. Where it was low, you wouldn't get a pattern to form. He took as an example, say one of these was a growth hormone. So where it would be high, you would get more growth. Where it would be low, you'd get less growth. And that might be a way that you could explain, say, branching in trees. More More generally, U or V would be a chemical that if it was in high concentration, you would get certain genes switching on or something, and if it was a low concentration, you wouldn't get a gene switching on, and therefore you'd get a pattern. So that was so there'd been a lot of work done on this. I mean, I'm not mentioning the names of the vast number of people who've worked on here. It would take too long. And I'm also actually following the approach of the esteemed journal Nature, where a few years ago there was something published in Nature that I didn't really agree with, and so I wrote a letter to Nature pointing this out, and they wrote back saying, well, you're right, but so many people have written in pointing this out that we're going to be fair and not publish anybody. So if it's good enough for Nature, it's certainly good enough for little me. But there's been a lot of work done. What you can show, and I'm sure a lot of you know about this, is that this system can give a huge range of patterns. You can analyze them in terms of certain biological manipulations. You can show that a lot of the predictions of this model are consistent with those experimental manipulations. But of course, that doesn't prove anything. Now, the question then arises, as if we evaluate what Turing said, well, first of all, Turing was the first person to really formalize the idea that cells responded to a chemical and differentiated accordingly. And he called those chemicals morphogens. And now morphogens have been shown to exist. It's taken 45, 50 years to find them, but morphogens do exist. So he got that right. He said that you could take a system like this and you could get an instability giving rise to spatial pattern. It took 40 years for people to prove that, but they have proved it in chemistry. People like Swinney, people like de Kepper, they proved that. So he got that right. So far he's 2 out of 2. The third point he made was that the patterns that you see in biology arise as the result of this instability. And that is still an open question. The one case in which it's been studied in detail was in Drosophila, and there in Drosophila, this model was proposed to describe the germ bands in early Drosophila. It's been proved categorically that that is incorrect. So this model doesn't apply to Drosophila. To try and extrapolate from that is a bit dangerous, since Drosophila, in terms of the animal kingdom, is a real weirdo. It's way out there. Nobody else does anything that Drosophila does. So to try and generalize from Drosophila is very difficult. It's a very dangerous thing to do, but Drosophila is the only thing we've got. So this makes this model extremely controversial for that reason, that nobody has found morphogens U and V that interact in the way proposed by Turing to give rise to patterns. So people have found this in chemistry, they found morphogens, but they still haven't found this system working in biology. Having said that, very recent work by people like Martin Howard in Imperial College in London, looking at how within certain cells, how they actually choose their division plane within certain bacteria, looks like it might well be a Turing mechanism. So that you might actually have a Turing mechanism causing pattern formation within a cell, rather than the original idea of Turing, which was pattern formation over a group of cells. So it would be very interesting, now that this work has just come out like the last couple of years, to see with more work on that whether that actually is the first Turing mechanism that's been discovered in biology. So that's very exciting. But I should mention that there are other models that have been proposed for these types of pattern formation based on very different biology, but they all give rise to quite similar mathematical results. And therefore, but the Turing model is the simplest, most model. So by studying the Turing models, one is really studying a class of models based on different biology proposed by different people, all to describe the same thing. And that's one reason for picking the Turing model. So in 1995 came this model with the rather sort of hysterical proclamation at the front here, which was nothing to do with the authors, to do with the journal. Turing patterns come to life, and then this very strange looking creature here, fish. And basically this was Kondo and Asai, two Japanese scientists, and I apologize, you can't see this too well, it's not the best transparency. What they found, studying, literally looking at in his fish tank, this fish, and it grows and gets bigger. Now, what do we know about pattern formation? I mean, as we, when we were born, we were sort of this height, and now we're this height, so we've grown, what, about five times or something, but we don't have five heads. We still just have one head. So in that respect, the pattern formation occurred very, very early in development, and all that happened was pattern grew. But it didn't develop anymore. But here's an example with stripes, which is different. Here you've got a fish that's got three stripes, and as it grows, those stripes, roughly speaking, stay the same width. They just get wider and wider. When they reach roughly twice the distance apart they were to begin with, another stripe pops up in the middle. And that stripe is popped up so that the wavelength is preserved. And this goes through a number of these things. And what they present here is a reaction diffusion model, a very, very simple version of reaction diffusion model, to show that. So this is concentration of one of the morphogens, one of the U or Vs, cell position. They have the domain growing, so this is time. The domain is growing. When you get it, roughly speaking, twice the distance apart, up pops the stripe in the middle. Now, they also did two-dimensional simulations of this, which I haven't presented, basically because I lost the slides of the rest of this paper. Another interesting thing, which probably most of you can't see here, is there's a fork-like thing here. And this is another way that some of these fish go from one stripe to two stripe. You actually have the propagation of a defect. So it's almost like a zipper, opening up a zipper, and this defect propagates along, turning one stripe into two. And they have nice simulations of this system giving rise to that pattern as well. So we decided to look at this in more detail. One of the things that intrigued us was the fact that these new structures here, the new stripes are actually thinner than the older stripes. Notice here the model predicts that the stripes would be of the same thickness. So the model is not quite right. Another thing is this really a mechanism in which cells are sitting there and they respond to a chemical and they differentiate accordingly? There are other models that have been proposed for pattern formation which are based on cell movement. And in fact, if you look at a number of species, you find that certainly in terms of animal coat markings, it seems to be that the cells have already decided what they're going to do, but they haven't decided where they're going to do it. They respond to a chemical, move in response to that chemotactically, and then where they end up, that's where they do their business. Sorry? Yeah, I mean, and that's what we're going to come along to talk about, yeah. Now, here's an example that sort of gives a bit of support to that, but it's a different fish. It's not the fish that we're looking at, and it's the zebrafish. And here, so zebrafish form stripes, and what actually happens is that the cells that are going to form the stripes, they start off in here, in a big cluster here, and then at a later stage, they're along here. They've migrated outwards due to some cue, and as a result of that, you view the stripes. So we're going to try and take that idea of, we're not going to throw away the Turing mechanism, we're going to say, let's suppose the Turing mechanism provides the chemotactic cues for the cells to move. So we need to add a third equation. This is work that is done in collaboration with Kevin Painter and Hans Ofmer. And what we do here, so cells are N, if you ignore these big red terms at the minute, what you have here is you have random motion, and then you have chemotaxis, exactly like Leah talked about. You have chemotaxis to U, K, chemotaxis to V with certain sensitivities. What I've written down here is the classic types of sensitivities that are used in the literature. So U and V are the morphogens from the reaction diffusion model, from the Kondo and Asai type model. And what we've done here is, of course, if you model this in a growing domain, you then have to have this extra term here where this is the velocity of the growth. So if you were to do this properly, what you'd want to do is look at how the cells divide within the fish or within the tissue, then from that describe how the growth occurs, and from that get a growth velocity. That's to do it properly. We haven't done it properly because this is just the beginning of a study on this. So we didn't want to run before we could walk. So what we decided to do was we were going to impose certain growth velocities and see what happens on the growing domain. So for example, we take a growth like this. And then this term we put in, if you break up this term into two pieces, you get a dilution rate plus a advective term. And what we did here was balance the rate of dilution by bringing in that extra term so that you have a conservation. And now we do exactly what Kondo and Asai did. We do it in one dimension to begin with. So you have a one-dimensional domain, which is here. We have it growing exponentially. We choose the parameter such that the reaction diffusion underlying pattern is going to be three stripes. We have the cells responding chemotactically by moving in response to those three peaks. And so what happens here is this is the cell density, so you get three stripes here. Now, as the domain grows larger, the underlying reaction diffusion system undergoes a transition to six peaks. And now these cells start to rearrange into six peaks, due to the fact that we've got this extra growth term, the NRX plus RY term coming in there. But what you find to begin with is that the peaks are different width. So it looks like we are getting what we wanted to get, but in this case we don't, because as you grow further and further, these peaks all end up becoming the same width. I should mention that that's actually observed in some fish. The new peaks start off thinner and then become thicker. Now, why did they start off thinner and then become thicker, given that the underlying chemical structure is always uniform, always the same thickness? Well, the reason is that the cell dynamics is working on a slower time scale. So it takes the cell dynamics longer to respond to this change in the underlying the underlying chemical structure. Here's zero flux. So everywhere it's zero flux boundary conditions. This is space, and it's growing exponentially. Yeah. Sorry? Yeah. So. Oh no, if we were to stop this here. But this is the fish is one dimensional here. So here's the boundary here and here, which is zero flux. And so it's just growing. So at this, so if we look at like here where it says 40, this is what it looks like taking the cross section. So here you have the zero flux boundary conditions here. And here you have the three yellow peaks. And then as the domain increases in size, here we've just rescaled it back to be the same size, you see getting these extra peaks coming in. So the wavelength will always stay the same here, because the wavelength is determined by the parameters, the kinetic parameters, and they're not changing. So if this fish grows to be... if we kept going this, we would get 3, then 6, then 12, then 18, but or 24, but the wavelength is always constant. Yep. That's Not in this case, no, but that's what we're coming on to. Because in this case, the underlying system, well, yeah, in this, I mean, you can sort of see it beginning to happen here. These stripes are very thin, and now they're getting a bit thicker. And in fact, if you were to continue this, by the time you got away over here, you'd find that these stripes were all the same width. So we haven't been able to capture the pomacanthus. We have been able to capture other fish that behave like this.
Mm-hmm. Nope.
Yep. Yep. In fact, we're going to come on to that where the growth is saturated. Yep. We're going to come on to that. Now, if you try and address one issue of can you get thick and thin stripes, if we look at, again, we're doing all of this in one dimension because it's a bit simpler. Let's ignore the growth terms for the minute and let's look at the steady state problem. The steady state problem looks like this. And we know that at primary bifurcation points in the reaction diffusion Turing mechanism, the turning points of the U and V coincide. So they're either in phase or 180 degrees out of phase. So whenever ux is naught, vx is naught, and therefore nx is naught. But notice that depending on the on these functional forms here, you could get a situation where ux and vx are non-zero, but nx is zero. So that's what we term complex pattern formation, and that's what gives you the thick and thin stripes. So you can have a situation where the underlying pattern in, say, the U and the V is just a simple cosine, with, say, one turning point, but at the N can have more than one turning point. And this is a sort of generalization of the interpretation of something called positional information, which was proposed by Lewis Wolpert, which is really an extension of what Turing had done, where the idea was that you've got some chemical gradient and then you have multiple thresholds. So there's some complicated functional of this input that decides how things differentiate. And here's our not so complicated functional in this case. So if you apply that to, you can in fact on two dimensions then end up getting as a stable, steady state thick and thin stripes. Now, as was mentioned, of course, things don't grow. Oh, the other thing I should point out, actually, is some just by the way, using that idea, you can actually get all sorts of patterns. So here's patterns where the underlying, the U and the V are cos 2x, cos 2y. And now by taking different chemotactic sensitivities, here's the patterns you can generate in the N. So all sorts of different stuff there. So before you continue with that, those were all based on the assumption that you had a uniform steady state in N and you did slight random fluctuations and it was unstable and it evolved to this pattern. But now suppose we start off with a situation like in the zebrafish where the cells are all clumped up to begin with. So we have an initial condition of a clump of cells. And let's not have the domain growing. We're doing these things one step at a time. So now we have initial condition was a big clump of cells here, and then we solve it on the fixed domain. We get this type of pattern. And this is where the initial conditions were like a line of cells, rectangle of cells, with this type of pattern. Now let's put the two things together. Let's have this type of initial condition, and let's have growth. And what happens, and this is with saturated growth. And again, these have been rescaled, so they look the same size, even though they've grown. You see here you get these curved stripes propagating outwards, and then you have the little stripes coming in as the domain grows.
Do the curved stripes actually propagate as a wave
They do. This one, the domain growth is extremely slow, so it would fill up the domain. But I should mention that there has been some work done on looking at the growth of the domain with the traveling wave of cells coming in behind it. And that's work that's recently been published in the absolutely fantastic journal Bulletin of Mathematical Biology I've forgotten the name of the first authors. People in Australia have done that. I can't remember the name of them. And they've then looked as to, you know, can the pattern catch up with the growing domain? Not that I know of in fish, but it happens in alligators. In alligators, you observe the propagation of the patterns in the back, not only propagating in one dimension, but also propagating sort of across the direction like that. Yeah? We're just, if we were to model this properly, what would be happening is, due to cell division and the actual growth of the cell, you get the domain growing. What we've done here is we've just imposed a velocity of growth on it. Yeah. So we're just imposing that. Yeah. That's right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So far you've all been very kind to me, because none of you have said, well, you've got 1,025 parameters and you can choose them to be what you like, so you can get anything you want out of this. Somebody once told me I could get an elephant out of this. So let's try and address that issue. I mean, were we just lucky? We just happened to choose parameter values that worked. So let's look at the different things. So let's first of all look at the idea that you get this mode doubling occurring. We had exponential growth, and we got this mode doubling occurring here, and it grows with a certain rate. So how sensitive is this to the growth rate? Well, what happens is, if we take the growth rate to be very large, this doesn't work. You get defects occurring. And basically what's happening in that case is that there has to be, in certain intervals, when this goes through a certain interval of time over which a pattern becomes unstable and can grow, if the domain is growing too rapidly, the domain will quickly get out of that window, so that the pattern that was trying to grow, suddenly it's lost its chance. So we could very easily understand why it is that if you had the domain growing very rapidly, you wouldn't get this periodic doubling. What we did find that we couldn't understand was that if the domain grew really, really slowly, this also didn't work. But we found that in the middle, and in the middle I mean like over 4 or 5 orders of magnitude, we get this to occur. So it's a very robust phenomenon. Now, we've been studying, using sort of numerical bifurcation, why it happens that this doesn't occur if the growth is extremely slow. And although we're still in the process of studying this, what seems to happen is represented in the schematic here, where here's a sort of bit of a bifurcation diagram. So here's a stable branch, and this is unstable branch, obviously. So what happens? So these dots are, this is with length, and these dots are how the pattern is growing, is evolving on the growing domain. And you can see here a situation that the pattern is going along here, and then this mode becomes unstable. But what it does is it drops on to the mode doubling. So I think this was mode 2, so this was caused 2x, so one bump in the middle. And now this is 2 bumps. And now even though that 2 bumps is unstable, it still continues along there until it becomes stable, and we've got successful mode doubling. Now here's a situation where, as we move along here and we drop off, looks like the same as before, but suddenly we drop off this one and go on to cause 3, which is 1.5 peaks. we stay on there. So we haven't had mode doubling. Difference between these two is in the growth rate. Here, the growth rate is smaller. So it meant that whatever the eigenfunctions were here, the unstable eigenfunctions, had a chance to grow and push us off the off this branch. Here, they didn't have time to grow and push us off the branch. So now, coming back to the question, of course, none of us grow exponentially, and some of us saturate sooner than others, unfortunately. So here's an example of logistic growth. So we have exponential growth to begin with, and then it drops off. And here you see what happened. We had this mode doubling occurring all in the exponential regime, but then the pattern froze. So whatever pattern we had in the exponential regime, we still have when it reaches steady state. And of course you're going to say, well, of course you just chose that one on purpose, didn't you? And so I'm honest. Here's an example where it doesn't occur, where you get, it looks like, well, 2, okay? And then once it, so it's got 2 here, but look, it changed to 3. And here's an example after growth stopped where it changed to 4. So sometimes this doesn't work. Now you have to take, you have to believe me when I say that the student who did this, Edmund Crampton, had to work extremely hard to get this. This one, this, the top one, is the more robust one. But definitely there are cases when it doesn't occur. Now, one of the theoretical problems with the Turing model is it gives multiple solutions, multiple stable solutions to this, if you just perturb the initial condition slightly, or you just perturb the parameter slightly, and people have known that for 30 years. So this means that if you're trying to generate an organism with one head, you don't want to have a mechanism where, depending on, you know, whether the animal, when it's pregnant or walks into a hot room or something and changes the condition slightly, it suddenly produces a two-headed monster. So the question, but that's what the Turing model would predict. And here's an example of this. And this is work with Edmund Crampton, who was a graduate student of mine, and Eamon Gaffney, who was a postdoc, which this is just, the details aren't important here. Basically, we choose a domain of a certain length. We choose parameters that will isolate mode 16, which is 8 humps. And then we just run the simulation from random initial conditions several times and see what answers we get. And sometimes we get what we want, which is mode 16, but you can see here we get very different values. These are for 3 different parameter runs, but each one of them, like for instance this one here, most of the time we actually got mode 14, sometimes mode 15, sometimes 16. But what would happen if you were to start off with the domain very small and grow it? Then you would all, in that simulation, you would always get mode 16. So this is an example where having growth actually selects only certain modes. So that's all well and good, providing you want a pattern that's got 2 to the n stripes, this period doubling. But I'll show later that we can get around that. Now, what you can show very, very simple using the tent map is that if you want the pattern to grow exponentially in terms of the number of, you know, grow 2, 4, 8, 16, you need to have exponential growth in the parameter, in the domain. What happens if you have linear growth? For example, the different types of growth, you find that it breaks down. So here it broke down here. You've got 1, 2, 3. Here it broke down a bit more, here it broke down a bit more. Roughly speaking, where it breaks down is where, if we had the exponential growth, roughly where the exponential curve would intersect here before it sort of took off. So really, what we've done there is to try and understand how things change in terms of the growth parameters. So now the question arises, how do they change in terms of the kinetics And here somebody had asked earlier on, what are the F's and the G's? So here is a growing domain. This is the growing domain where we've just rescaled it back to 0,1. This is time. Here's two models. This is a Schnackenberg model. This is a Gehr-Meinhardt model. And you can see here, this is the example of the Kondo Nassai. You get peak splitting. You get peak insertion, I mean. Peak insert there and there. Here's an example where you get splitting occurring. And here's an example where you get a pattern that's actually invariant. This just stays as a simple cosine. So now we try to understand that, and we have a partial understanding of that in a limiting case, which is this case here. We know that for diffusion-driven instability, the activator has to have a slower diffusion than the inhibitor. Let's make that diffusion really, really slow. Have it like this, and this is the growth we represented like this here. What we find is that there are two time regimes for very small rho. So now we're looking at very small growth rate. There's a quasi-steady state regime where nothing much is happening, and the system looks like this. And now we're going to take as a toy model an F and a G that have linear terms here, so we can choose the parameters so that we get the instability, the Turing instability, and now we're going to choose some simple non-linear terms. And what we find is the following, that if epsilon is, so this is all very standard stuff actually, when epsilon is small and if there's not very much change in the second derivative, we have a solution like this. But of course, where there is a transition and a sharp sort of solution, by rescaling, we have a solution like this. So what we can do by using very standard approaches is that we have this sort of thing here. This is V and U. So here, this corresponds to that part of the branch, because U is large, V is large, this corresponds to V being negative. What you find is that these two branches are stable, that branch is unstable, and the dynamics are such that you move down this branch the same time you move up that branch. That corresponds to this moving up and that moving down. So now it's a race, which one will you reach first? If you reach this one first and move across, means that moves up and you have an insertion. If that moves up first, goes across, you then have a splitting. And you can see from this that if this was purely perfectly symmetrical, which it is actually in this diagram, those things would happen at the same time. And therefore you'd get another type of behavior, which would be mode tripling. And that's in fact what occurs. And here's an example of the mode tripling happening here. Okay. So really what we find then is by looking at the non-linearity of the system, we can decide whether or not we're going to get the peak insertion, which is what Kondo Nassai got, or we could get a peak splitting. But it depends on the non-linearity. So it really has it means look at the non-linearity, not so much at the parameters, just at the non-linearity of the system. And then if, for example, the null clines happen to look like this, where there was actually no need to fall off, then you would get no splitting or insertion, so you would get the pattern that just stayed on forever. So with that, we've got a bit of a handle on understanding how this pattern occurs, what governs the type of behavior that you get. Now, I mentioned along all of this, we've been talking about having uniform growth. So the domain is growing uniformly. In fact, in a lot of biological systems, what happens is you have growth at one end. And then this is what you get, and this is work with Bill Hackborn, who was a visitor to a group a while back. So this is now time here, distance here, one dimension again, and here's a situation, if we walk through, start off here, this is the domain, certain size, it grows a little bit bigger and we get an insertion. Grows a little bit more big, we get another insertion. Whereas here we're getting peak splitting, so grows a little bit more, the forward peak splits, forward peak splits, forward peak splits. So this enables us to get robustly any size of pattern we want. Because remember, the previous exponential growth restricted us to getting 2 to the n. And again, in this situation here, we choose kinetics that would give rise to insertion, and in this case, we choose kinetics that would give rise to splitting. So that idea that we figured out for the exponential growth also works here. So we've also done work on different types of growth, but I'm not going to go into that. And for the last few minutes, I just want to give a couple of examples. So one example of pattern in growing domain, this is bivalve ligaments. So bivalve are shells, and they've got ligaments which allow them to sort of open and close. And this problem was brought to us by Roger Thomas, who's a paleontologist in the U.S., and this was work done by Anatita Vazmamuz, who was a postdoc of mine, and Andy Wathen, who was the numerical analysis supervisor of Anatita. And basically what happens here is as these things grow, so you've got them growing down like this, they lay down this mixture of ligament and fibrous tissue. And roughly speaking, it either looks in the chevron pattern or it looks in a vertical pattern. And these chevron types are called the arcoids, family arcoid, and this type here are called the neotids. Now, there are a number of different reasons why these are considered to be two different families. One of the main reasons is because of their morphology. This is different looking to this one. So what Roger Thomas said to us, if we could find a situation where you could have a model mechanism that gives rise to one of these patterns, and you change something ever so slightly, and you get the other pattern, then that calls into question the whole interpretation that those two things must be very different because they look different. So basically, the problem he gave us to look at was, can we start off with a pattern formation mechanism, change one parameter, and go from there to there? That was our problem. So since we're working in this growing domain problem, that's what we tried to do. And what we found was we had to take Dirichlet boundary conditions now. So these are not zero flux. These are fixed boundary conditions. And what we find here, the domain grows and you're getting the chevron pattern occurring like this. And now remember, we're allowed to change one parameter. So the parameter we change is we put an internal boundary condition here. We say, let this boundary have a fixed, let this have a fixed chemical concentration. So we don't know what the reason is, but let's just suppose that is the case. And if we do that, we end up getting, I mean, this is a bad picture because we didn't plot everything. It's sampled at certain lengths, at certain time intervals, but you can sort of see that you're going to get these patterns that go vertically. That's not a big surprise to us, but apparently the paleontologists got very excited by that. The second problem I want to look at then in the last couple of minutes is a problem of butterfly wing patterns. This is work done with Toshio Sekimura and Fred Nyhut, who knows everything you ever want to know about butterflies and a lot more stuff that, quite frankly, you don't want to know. And but if you're stuck in the lift with him, you find out. Tarsier was looking at Papilio dardanus, and it turned out that this creature four different species has four different patterns. I'm not going into details of this, because I'm running out of time. I'll just show you how we can use the reaction diffusion model to get these. That's not so good. By the patterns. But what I need to point out is that all these simulations are wrong. Because, of course, the pattern occurs while the domain is growing. And here what we did was we took the species, the full adult wing. So what we need to do, and this is ongoing work, this is the best we've got so far, so you can see that we're struggling, of a growing wing. Okay, so we're trying to get better pictures than this, because basically you have to tear the wing off. So this leads to all sorts of problems, like how do I line up this wing with that wing? I don't know, and the biologist doesn't seem to know either. But the idea then is we have a domain like this growing. Once we've got better data on this, we can have a proper wing growing. And then we can, and this is just proof of principle, we can then start solving our model on a properly growing domain and see what happens. So I'll end there just summarizing that what we've done is a number of things. First thing is we've shown that taking the Turing model and adding chemotaxis to it gives what I call these complex patterning. And when you think about it, it's very, very simple. It's basically superposition of modes, so nothing clever in that at all. But you can get all sorts of different patterns, and particularly you can get the thick and thin stripes as stable, steady states. That motivated us to look into more detail at the growth that underlies the reaction diffusion patterning. What we saw was that growth was a stabilizing process in the sense that it could enhance certain symmetries, certain modes, and other modes wouldn't occur as a result of it. We also looked in more detail at the kinetics of the reaction diffusion system to see which kinetics choose which mode of pattern transition that occurs. And then finally, we have the application to the bivalves, where it's given a sort of a new interpretation to the fact that these neotids and arcoids might actually be more closely related than people thought they were, and also the looking at the butterflies, which I haven't written down here, again, it was the similar problem. The problem there is that these species, you know, these Papilio dardanus, how come they're different colors? And how come the colors are different? Can we, by changing a minimum number of parameters, go from one to the other so that we can show that they're related in some way? And that's really all I want to say. So thank you for your time, and sorry for running over a couple of minutes.